and she's a departmental lecturer in social anthropology at Oxford University. And we've mostly had LSE people here in our seminar series, and the reason why we invited her is that when we invited her, she was actually still at LSE, and then she moved on to Oxford. Congratulations. She did her PhD in anthropology here at LSE in 2014, and her research looked at middle-class women from Latin America who exchanged care and intimacy for money while working as domestic workers and sex workers here in London. And after her PhD, she did research with Hispanic migrant families in Oklahoma, looking at networks of care and inequality. And more recently, Anna was part of an ESRC-funded project for which she analyzed the role of advice offered by non-profit organizations in the context of Spain's rapidly shrinking welfare state. But I think today you're mainly going to be talking about your PhD, right?
Yeah.
Which has been published as a book, which month? Just very recently.
Yeah, I remember.
This
yeah.
year, last, was it 2018 or 2019?
It was 2018, but yeah.
So congratulations on that as well. Maybe you can tell us the title of it. I didn't write it down. I thought you'd have one with you.
Oh, yeah, I'm very bad at it. Care for Sale.
Care for Sale.
Yeah.
And it came out with, was it Routage?
OUP.
OUP, well done. All right.
Thank you. Well, I know that in the title, the original title, I actually said that I was going to talk about Madrid as well, because that was my intention, because I actually, in Madrid, I work with also Latin American migrants. But when I started writing, it was just too much information. So I'm going to focus on the London research, but definitely many of the things that I'm going to talk about resonate with the same sort of racial discourses and class locations of these Latin American migrants in Madrid. Okay, so apologies for that. Okay, I'm gonna read my paper, but I hope it's okay with you. If you have any questions, you just feel free to interrupt me at any point. Okay, so Sonia from Bolivia had a relatively stable middle class life where she owned a pharmacy, taught at university, and worked part-time at a local hospital. Her recently graduated daughter wanted to travel to Europe. She wanted to see the world before finding a job back in Bolivia and settle down. Sonia did not hesitate to borrow $4,000 to make her dream come true. This trip represented a good opportunity for her daughter to experience the things that she never could. Paulina flew to Madrid on the 11th of March 2004, the same day of the terrorist attack in the train station of Atocha in Madrid, so her plane was sent back home. After the failed trip and with £2,000 less in ready cash, she again insisted on going to Europe, this time to Italy. To please her daughter, Sonia asked for a second bank loan, and therefore she borrowed $2,500 from one bank and $500 from another bank. On this occasion, she and Paulina agreed that Paulina would repay the money once she found a job. Once in Italy, not only she was unable to find work, but she also fell in love and got pregnant. Although Paulina's pregnancy represented a financial problem, Sonia's main disappointment was that her daughter had fallen in love with a Bolivian. Un indio, ya ves, an Indian, you see, and not a white Italian who would have given her documents and white babies with blue eyes. Pretty babies, she told me. Sonia's aspiration of increasing her family's social status by whitening her grandchild had been frustrated by her daughter's choice of partner. On top of this, she had entered into an endless cycle of debt that she was not able to sustain any longer. As a way to rectify the mess she had put herself into, she decided to migrate temporarily to London in order to save money and pay her debts. As she explained back then, many people were moving to London due to fewer restrictions in comparison to the US, to increasingly well-established social networks, and the possibility to find employment in the service sector. What started as a project that represented upward mobility for her daughter turned into an experience that affected Sonia's identifications as a middle-class woman from Bolivia, experiencing important personal dislocations due to the downward status mobility and racial mobility that characterized her migration journey. So in this paper, I analyze the stories of a group of women from Latin America that found themselves struggling to sustain middle-class aspirations as a result of their migration projects. Dispossessed from previous class and racial identifications, women cling to an idealized self-perception of a higher status infused by white Eurocentric aspirations, as a resource to negotiate current anxieties and precarious economic conditions. These idealized notions of selfhood are deeply infused by the intertwinement that persists in Latin America between race and class. I follow the ways in which women reproduce class and racial dynamics from their countries while in London, as a way to differentiate themselves from other migrants and elaborate distinctions that allow them to reconstruct their affected statuses. So this paper is based on ethnographic research conducted mainly between August 2009 and April 2011. However, also the fieldwork has been ongoing throughout all these years in London with women migrants from various parts of Latin America. My informants, although were from different countries in Latin America, they did not share a common nationality, ethnicity, or in many cases background. They all self-identified as middle class, despite their occupying a variety of positions within the wider middle classes in their countries. In the narratives of class identification, they shared similar ideas regarding home ownership, access to higher education, credentials, moral values, and consumption as means through which they could symbolically and materially attain and perform their class identity. In recent years, however, due to the deterioration of their economic conditions in their home countries, they were no longer able to improve their social status through education, and therefore found themselves facing increasing levels of unemployment, debt, and lack of opportunities to achieve not only economic security for themselves and their families, but to advance their middle-class aspirations, hence their migration. For self-identified middle-class women from Latin America, who had no English skills, no recognized educational qualifications, no relevant work experience in the UK, and for some, no legal status, or an insecure legal status, the opportunities were far between. As a result, they were pulled into occupations that they had never done before, and they were once considered menial or lowly, that is, domestic and sex work. On the one hand, London represented the possibility to attain an upward mobility by paying the debts back in their countries, maintaining their families at a distance, constructing new families, or experiencing new adventures in Europe. On the other hand, their new occupations, insecure legal statuses, and precarious conditions in London produce sharp downward status mobility and force them to inhabit social and racial locations that they, as middle-class people, rejected back in their countries. So let me just give you a little bit of the history of middle-class, how it's understood, the history of middle-class in Latin America. So it's been argued that the creation of middle-class in Latin America started in the mid-19th century as part of the creolization project based on an ideal bourgeois European lifestyle to modernity and morality. These subjects were located between the elite, those with wide European backgrounds, and the poor people, those who were indigenous or black. From the late 1940s to the mid-1960s, there was a special interest in the impact of the growing middle classes in the region because they were tied to state-supported industries and public bureaucracies. They were either perceived as central actors involved in the processes that led to the attainment of democracy, stability, and development, or quite the opposite, at those who, due to their position in the middle, held conservative ideologies and were therefore reluctant to take risks. During the debate of the 1980s, with the insertion of structural adjustment programs across the region, some claimed that the middle classes were doomed to disappear. Instead, however, they were replaced by a new middle class composed by self-employed entrepreneurs, large and small. These new middle classes enjoy the opportunity not only to have access to consumer goods as never before, but also to improve their social prestige through higher education. The situation nonetheless started changing from the 1990s onwards, when university degrees no longer guaranteed a middle-income job. The consequence was the upsurge of a middle class defined less by education and stable employment in the public sector and more by an aspirational lifestyle. So as many scholars have suggested, education, lifestyle, taste, family name, and connections are fundamental pieces in the definition of the middle classes in Latin America. However, this complex class identity cannot be fully understood without its historical colonial intersections with race, more specifically with being or becoming white. Race, skin color, plays a fundamental role in the process whereby people position themselves and others within the social pyramid. This is reflected in the fact that those who belong to the elite are white, while the poor and the working class are considered to be black or indigenous. The history of such identifications goes back to the colonial cultural logic that was imposed on the continent, particularly in the 19th and early 20th century, when there was a common preoccupation with race and race mixture in relation to progress, modernity, education, and civilization. By the 1920s and 30s, several countries in the region started constructing their national ideologies around the idea of an all-encompassing mestizaje, or miscegenation. According to Peter Way, mestizaje, despite its homogenization rhetoric, it is in fact, and I quote, an all-inclusive ideology of exclusion, end of quote, that incorporates a de facto racial hierarchy whereby blacks and indigenous people will eventually evaporate through a process of blanqueamiento, which means whitening. Since its inception, the concept of mestizaje as a new mixed modern citizenry was highly racialized. Still, as Wade suggests, the differences between Indio and Mestizo were, and still are, not necessarily based mainly on skin color or even physical appearance more generally, but on language, dress, occupation, and place of residence. Indeed, mestizaje is more complex in its racial politics of meanings and social implications than its usual rendering as mixed race. According to Goldberg, insofar as racial mixing came to define Latin Americanization, it became, and I quote, elevated by making the mimicking of the European habits the defining aspiration. Even more, it became the condition of possibility of racial elevation, end of quote. Though these colonial discourses could be regarded as obsolete, I witness the prevalence and reproduction of such vestiges through various narratives, discourses, and social practices among the women I work with. As many scholars on race in Latin America have found, my informants use any hint of whiteness, such as a narrow nose, a white ancestor, or sometimes having or claiming a high social status as a way to whiten themselves. As Goldberg explains, the idea of becoming whiter or lightening the race goes hand in hand with the notion of upward mobility, which is intimately articulated through race, class, and gender. For example, Felipa from Mexico, the only woman in my research who self-identified as an indigenous woman, for her, migrating as a living domestic worker for a rich Mexican family, offered her a unique possibility to advance economically and socially. She had been in the UK for more than 20 years by the time I met her, had a Spanish passport, and had been able to construct a solid patrimony for herself and her family back in Mexico through her care work. With no intentions of going back to Mexico, Felipa, at 40, was ready to become a mother. In the search for a father for her child, Felipa was adamant at disrupting her racial and ethnic heritage based on the discrimination that she suffered while growing up in Mexico. I am already dark. I needed someone white to whiten my child. I needed to mejorar la raza, she told me in a jokingly kind of way. Popular pejorative expressions throughout Latin America like mejorar la raza, or better in the race, which refers to marrying lighter, or don't be an Indian and it had to be a black person, strongly signaled the undesirability of non-white categories. This was also reflected in the story of Eva from Peru, who decided to leave the country 17 years ago, not only due to the insecurity and violence in the country, but also because she wanted to avoid the shame of being associated with the indigenous background of her daughter's father. He was, according to her, de lo más profundo del Peru, from the deepest part of Peru, an implicit racist remark that suggests having an indigenous background. Fortunately, from her perspective, her daughter had inherited the white genes on her family's side and not the Indian ones of the father. This whiteness, combined with the possibility of growing up in Europe, will eliminate all traces of indigenousness and will secure her daughter's future in Spain and then in London. Except for Felipa, most of the people I met and work with consider themselves white and referred to others, less white, as morochos, coyas, morenas, there were all these different shades of brown. And in the case of Brazilians with black ancestry, only one self-identified as mulata, and explained it in terms of the mixing that existed within her family. Overall, the categories black or indigenous were avoided because of the valued characteristics, even among those who claim to have indigenous or black parents or grandparents. They would rather use the intermediate categories morena or mulata because, as Tellis and Pasio have argued, these categories simultaneously emphasize social values of race mixture and proximity to whiteness. The racial category of mulata, for instance, was explained to me by Juliana in the context of domestic work and the racial inequality that persists in Brazil. As a self-identified mulata, Juliana, who used to work as a telephonist for a state company back in Brazil, wanted me to understand the difference that existed between being a domestic worker in London and in Brazil. In Brazil, she told me, domestic work was a prevalent job for pretas or mulatas, black or mixed race. because those who had lighter skin automatically had better opportunities in life. Juliana's explanation resonates with Lovell's arguments regarding how the majority of Afro-Brazilian remain confined to domestic work because this occupation has the lowest wages within the Brazilian economy. Juliana was aware of the correlation that existed between race and poverty in Brazil, and how they were this correlation was reproduced everywhere, even in the media. You see it all over. For example, in the soap operas, black women always play the role of the maid. They were never the protagonists, she told me. In contrast, in her view, London provided a less differentiated racial landscape because being a mulatta and a domestic worker was not inextricably linked as it was in Brazil. According to her, race or class were not necessarily markers of one's job in London. The fact that she was a domestic worker in London was due to being a migrant. By distinguishing between the two countries and the racial politics that accompany domestic work, Juliana could place herself on one side of the spectrum, where she was not a mulatta working as a faxineira or a domestic worker, but an educated migrant temporarily working as a domestic worker. It was not her African ancestry that determined her occupation in London, but her condition as a migrant with fewer opportunities. Racial categories that included some sort of mixture acquire a different meaning and value among those women who work in sex work, or they use them as strategies to promote their business within different working spaces. The competitiveness of the sexual market in London pushed women to reconfigure themselves as racially sexualized women from Latin America, whose exoticism resided on their mixed racial backgrounds. For instance, Angelica from Brazil once explained that she would usually be called to take part in the Latin American swing parties because she fitted the racial category of what clients imagine of an exotic Latina beauty. They call me because I am morena, with long brunette hair and brown eyes. I am neither white nor black. Some, like Amanda, from Brazil as well, who had fair skin and considered herself a white Brazilian, talked about her bunda, the buttocks, as a way to exacerbate her Brazilianness, when she worked as a stripper and then while working in private flats. In Brazil's popular culture, ample female hips, buttocks, and thighs have been the aesthetic ideal. Plastic surgery specifically references this tradition. Surgeons praise the beautiful effects of racial mixture of the female body, echoing older nationalist celebrations of mestizaje. Ads promote techniques to achieve a Brazilian bunda, or use samba song lyrics to advertise the slender petal waist as a national ideal. Clients love the big bunda. They think that all Brazilian women look like this, Amanda told me. Sabrina, whose mother is an Afro-Brazilian, did not consider herself as a mulatta, but an exotic morena who had a complex mixture of different racial backgrounds. I am misturada. It's mixed. I have black, white, and indigenous blood. I take advantage of my indigenous looks in order to get clients, as this makes me quite exotic. I am a total mistura, just like Brazil. Mistura is a market of mixed race, which is, according to Da Silva, one step on the road toward complete whitening. In other words, emphasizing their Brazilianness through their bodies and skin color, it became an efficient way to advertise in their services and competing in the racially varied and saturated sexual market, but it did not affect the racial identifications, which were located closer to the white spectrum, or at least including it. As Da Silva states in Brazil, and I quote, anybody is more or less black, more or less white, more or less both. These racial identifications cannot be fully understood without the intersection that they have with particular forms of affect and the way in which it produces stereotypes of certain migrant groups. In my own research, the affective labor that domestic and sex workers perform corresponded to the perception of certain affective qualities that employers and clients thought that these women embodied. I have explored this connection in my own work, but for now I'm not going to be able to deep into that. Let me just go back of the interplay of racial categories and class among my informants. Although mixed race categories were useful in the sex market, as I have explained, being morena, mixed race, or having some physical traits that were associated to non-white people could also be disadvantages as they could signal lower class locations and its concomitant cultural traits. Vanessa and Barbara, both from Colombia, often enjoyed guessing people's nationalities from Latin America by way of analyzing their style of dress and lack of taste. People with indigenous looks, those cholitas, for instance, as Barbara called women from Bolivia who looked indigenous, were simply not able to look good in jeans. It does not really matter what they wear, they cannot get rid of their indigenous look, she told me, while pointing at women passing by at Elephant and Castle shopping center. I think it comes down to the anatomy, the type of body. With ample hips, flat bottoms, and prominent bellies, it is difficult to look good in tight jeans, Vanessa reiterated. For them, the whiter people were, the better they could pull off clothes and style. With phrases like they just cannot help it, the racial judgment spoke of wider cultural notions about inferior, fixed racial traits that stand in opposition to the mainstream white superior traits. These notions confirm what Wade explains as a way as the key to race in Latin America, that is, that racism and mixture coexist and interweave, creating societies in which categories such as black and indigenous exist and are part of the national imaginary. Yet, due to the fact that modernity, development, and high status are often associated with whiteness, or at least mixedness, people with lighter skin automatically place themselves on the top of the racial pyramid. People like Vanessa and Barbara, who self-identified as white, did not find it problematic to judge people's states based on racial traits. After all, they might have been Latin Americans, but according to their own national and racial classifications, they were whiter than other Latin Americans, something that automatically granted them with a higher status and a sense of distinction. How am I going? Do I still have time? Yeah? Okay. In a similar vein, Amelia from Venezuela was adamant and displayed markers of taste and distinction that could reveal her real status. As an entrepreneur who had worked in real estate back in Venezuela and Madrid, Amelia was deeply humiliated and resentful about being a domestic worker in London. Having lost this position, she found a way to ameliorate some of the tensions by spending most of her free time shopping at TK Maxx, trying to find signature clothes at second-hand shops in South Kensington in West London, and car boot sales with her friend Eva. While walking through the aisles, Amelia often stopped in front of the sunglasses section and tried on at least 20 pairs. Look, Anna, I look like a posh woman from South Kensington, not like a cachifa in London, from London. A cachifa is a Venezuelan term for domestic worker. She liked to explain to Eva and me how people made the mistake of buying sunglasses just for the sake of showing off the brand, although they often did not fit the shape of their faces. According to her, the need to show off branded goods without taking into account the intangible aspects of fashion was irrefutable evidence of bad taste, lack of distinction, and class. Through the idiom of fashion as a form of symbolic capital, Amelia was performing a social class that was infused with a white sense of distinction that she felt she rightly belonged to, regardless of her present precarious situation in London. Regardless people's class and racial backgrounds, through markers of taste, reading people's class and racial backgrounds through markers of taste were common at transnational social events. Within migration studies, the concept of transnationalism has been used as an analytic category to explore the connections between people and places, connections that extend well beyond obvious national borders. Social events as birthday parties, christenings, carnavales, beauty contests, among others, function as transnational spaces where migrants socially and materially reconstructed distinct aspects of their personhood and established links between their countries of origin and the new location. These events, as I will show, were also opportunities where people momentarily put their dislocated London lives to one side, felt at ease, and performed who they really were. The baptism of Lourdes' grandchild was a festive occasion, from Bolivia, sorry. One-year-old Camila's baptism, in which I was asked to be the godmother, was a day to celebrate. Following the ritual at a Catholic church, which introduced Camila into the faith, the celebration became a day of lavish consumption and a performance of status and class. As the godmother, there were certain responsibilities which I was required to fulfill. One included overseeing the purchase of Camila's christening gown. After viewing various options, I decided to buy a simple christening gown that I thought would be proper for the occasion. When I showed the dress to Patricia, Camila's mother, and Lourdes, they looked quite disappointed at my choice. Saying that it was the incorrect size, they told me that I needed to change it. In search of advice, I turned to Giovanna and showed her the dress that I had selected. "Ay, Anna, you don't understand. This dress is way too plain for their taste. These are low-class people that like flashy things and want to make an impression at this type of event. You need to buy a big garish dress for Camila," she told me. I was surprised by Giovanna's remarks about Lourdes' family social class, especially by the condescending tone she was using while describing them. Her explanation was simple. They belonged to a different class. It was not only their taste, but the fact that Lourdes' family came from an indigenous background that gave Giovanna the authority to signal them as lower class. For Giovanna, a self-identified white person race was intrinsically linked to a sense of taste which was not properly white but aspirational. This aspirational taste that, according to her, did not fit a middle-class aesthetic, revealed Pedro's and Lourdes' background. This belief, however, stood in sharp opposition to the way in which Pedro and Lourdes defined themselves as middle-class people, particularly in relation to their levels of education. Whenever we talked about Bolivia, or when I asked them about their own class identifications, Pedro and Lourdes explained that they could not identify themselves as poor people. The poor people in my country are really poor and have no real opportunities to improve. My mother was poor. She was an indigenous woman who spoke Quechua, but she did not want us to learn the language and made huge efforts to send us to school in order to have better opportunities in life. If I have to choose, I would probably say I am a middle class because I am educated, Lourdes told me. Even though in the eyes of other Bolivians they look indigenous and were more morenos than blancos, they did not ascribe themselves as indigenous with an indigenous background or identity. She was also very keen and reminded me that Pedro had a master's degree, something that was a clear sign of their middle class. Despite their social and racial backgrounds in Bolivia, events such as the baptism, this christening, allowed people to make sense of their new homes, to find themselves in their new realities. While on the one hand, in the making of new place, they were able to reinvent their social class and race, partly due to the fact that the UK does not recognize Latin Americans as an ethnic category or as a racial group. On the other hand, they remained trapped by the social class, ethnic and racial stereotypes that prevailed in their countries. In this regard, for Pedro and the baby's father, the baptism was an opportunity to display their new status by splurging on the event, trying to make people feel at home, and at the same time displaying their own sense of distinction and taste. In this case, they were not interested in displaying European Western symbols of sophistication as a sign of success, but show their success by being able to recreate home in London. They had both spent more than £1,000 on the party, renting the venue, food, music, entertainment for children, alcohol and food for the adults, sweets, gifts for the kids, birthday cake, and a Bolivian piñata. As Pedro said, this party is as good as it gets back in Bolivia, but this is even better because we are in London. These sorts of events reproduce secure familiar spaces where, apart from enjoying food from their country, they could reclaim some parts of the everyday dislocated selves. As Cecilia said in the party, today I do not look like a domestic worker, I look like myself. To which Karina jokingly replied, yes, you might not look like a domestic worker, but you still have the hands of one. Though the remark was meant as a joke, it hints at the tension that existed between women's realities and their reimaginings of previous notions of the self. It refers to the embodied experience of a class dislocation through the physical evidence of dried hands, calluses, and ruined manicures. Now, what fish? Amongst my informants, there existed a complex interaction between the past in relation to who they really were and the present, a side in which they existed as different people, different from that person from the past. Although the past certainly includes idealized notions of personhood, it nonetheless had a powerful impact on the way in which women performed class and racial identities in front of others in London. As I have shown, these identifications maintain colonial racial ideologies that have created deep social and class fractures in Latin America. The stories presented in this paper expose various practices that reproduce such fractures in the women's lives in London. While many of these practices are indeed racist and classist, they are also efforts that people who are trapped in the middle of precarious and uncertain futures make in order to reconstitute their disrupted personhood, their dislocated class, racial and social statuses, while at the same time generating new ones that unfortunately create further divisions and fractures. That's it. Yeah. I hope I see you soon.
We've got plenty of time for discussion. That's nice. Any questions? Maybe I'd start off with one while you gather your thoughts. I was just wondering about methods, sort of how did you find these people, how did you gain access, and related to that, becoming a godmother. It's quite a commitment, and I was wondering whether choosing you as a godmother, and I don't want to say, you know, that they just did it for instrumental reasons.
Yeah.
They did it because they really liked you, but was it part of these aspirations?
Yeah. Well, in terms of access, it was a bit random, I guess, as we find all the time in anthropology, right? I met one of them in a bus stop in Brixton, who was going to a Latin American party, and we were going to the same sort of party at the beginning of field work, and she introduced me to the domestic workers, right? And she introduced me to other women, and it was relatively easy, because I mean, in the case of the domestic workers, most of these women spend most of the time working, living alone, you know, trying to survive in the city. So the fact that there was someone who was interested in listening to their lives, and I mean, of course, since the beginning, I had to explain to them that I was doing this research, that, you know, that it was going to be a long-term sort of thing. But in terms of the domestic workers, it was relatively easy, and it was like a snowball sort of effect. The sex workers were a bit more complicated. I started working for an NGO, and then I basically started contacting women via the internet, telling them that I was this researcher searching for these like stories of women migrants in London, etc. And that's, I met one of them, and again, the snowball sort of effect. And yes, of course, christening added, I mean, yeah, of course, we became really close, and this is one of the sort of like the outcomes of doing participant observation and long-term field work. But definitely the fact that it was funny because since the beginning, they were also hint at my racial sort of traits, and they will always ask me, like, you're not Mexican, you look like a gringa. Like, all the time, this was like this sort of narrative around me. And I was like very adamant saying, no, I'm not gringa, I'm from Mexico, and I, you know, also have this mixed race, you know, I'm not really white. I mean, but these like racial politics that are very complicated in Latin America. But on top of that, when I was doing research and when they asked me to be the godmother, my ex-partner was a British man who was an immigration lawyer, and that for them was like the epitome. Yeah, it was, of course, and it wasn't really me. You know, of course they liked me, but it was, you know, because in this party they were showing off, you know, the lawyer, you know, the British lawyer. You know, they had actually acquired this sort of connection with a person that was not Latin American, that was a British white lawyer that spoke Spanish, you know, and that he was the godfather of this baby. So, of course, these things played into race. Even in my relationship with them, race was always an issue that, of course, in their perception, of course, was cross-cut by class, and, of course, was cross-cut by class all the time. Right, but yeah, it was a thing that it was tacit. We had, I mean, many of we, I mean, in some cases, I talked to people like openly about race, like ask them about, you know, what are the racial sort of dynamics back in different countries, etc. But it was just a very short, like very specific moments when they will actually compose racial sort of identifications, but in the everyday life, they were there all the time, and they were always kind of trying to reproduce a forms of making themselves more sophisticated and whiter and better than other people, etc. Yeah.
wanted to talk a little bit more about transnationalism in particular. You kind of done like the positives about the events and creating communities, as well as kind of the negatives of reproducing racial structures, kind of the more the impact of transnationalism on this process.
Oh, the negative impact.
Oh, positive and negative, just kind of your interpretation of that concept.
Yeah, well, actually, I think the positive, I mean, in like the social events that I, for example, one that I didn't talk about because I didn't, I mean, I didn't have time, except it was, I was the judge of a beauty pageant, yeah, Miss Santa Cruz. I wanted to include it, but sorry, but well, I'll tell you about it because that's a negative implication. Okay, on the one hand, these transnational events did allow people to, I mean, these are people who were really affected, you know, their notions of how they were middle class people, whether they were or not, you know, to me that was not an issue because they self-identified as middle class. However, I mean, this middle class sort of concept is quite problematic in itself. But they were, when they came to London and they found that London was not white, that, you know, it had these Indianos, Morenos, Musulmanes, I mean, this place that, like, what happened to this place, you know? I thought it was white and people spoke this, like, broken language and they distorted the English. I mean, all these sort of racist remarks, but they were acting, I think, in fact, they were very shocked about the landscape in London. That on the one hand. On the other hand, they found themselves, I mean, they were, most of them, they had higher education. And they, but, I mean, of course, they didn't have any social connections. They didn't have, their qualifications were not recognized in the UK. They ended up working in these forms of labor that are, back in their countries, are actually, you know, they belong to those people that will never be middle class, you know, to the poor, to the indigenous people, to the black people, to the brown people. So transnational events, in that sense, did work as a way to find spaces to reproduce this middle class, you know, which of course is completely related to these racial locations in regarding, you know, being more white than others. But for instance, the beauty pageant, right? I was a judge, and there were like four women. Actually, I need to go to another one because I want to write an article about this, but I need to update my. Anyways, there was four women. This was Miss Santa Cruz, and I remember that we were four judges, yeah, four women. And there was like the favorite one was like this super white woman from Santa Cruz, which looked like a Barbie doll sort of thing, just with black hair. But, you know, slim, tall, super white, etc. And there was another woman. She was a dark skin, you know, with indigenous looks. She was quite young, you know, straight hair. I mean, she looked, I mean, this is stereotypes, of course, but she had indigenous sort of features, and she looked more Latin American than others, right? But, I mean, you know, there were all these, like, I don't know, they were interviewed, and they talked about world peace, and, you know, the whatever. So when we voted, I voted for the woman who looked more indigenous, because, well, I truly believe that she was the best candidate. And among the judges were like two of them were trying to go for the super white one, and two of us were trying to go for this one, right? At the end, you know, I don't know, I think we flipped a coin or something, and this woman that looked more indigenous won. When my friends asked me, like, okay, who do you vote for? I said, well, I vote for her. They just couldn't believe it. They were like, how could you? Like, she was clearly not the favorite. She was clearly not the most beautiful woman. Like, why would you choose a morena rather than the white one? You know, this white woman is so perfect. She looks European. She looks like us, like the people from Santa Cruz. I was like, okay, but isn't that other woman also from Santa Cruz? Like, so these sort of events that they keep on doing, because this is a beauty pageant that they repeat every year. This is a transnational, sort of like a negative aspect of these transnational sort of events, where actually these racial underpinnings that have to do with white locations in opposition to the indigenous inferiority are replicated over and over and over again, even in the new place. So in that sense, I mean, they never invited me as a judge. They never did. But I want to come back at least as a witness. But yeah, I think it's both in a weird way. Yes.
The women themselves are reinforcing these, even with new opportunities around them.
Yep. Yeah. 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 I mean, it sounds. It took me a lot of time to write this stuff. I was actually, in my thesis, I kind of like didn't touch much about this stuff, but my examiner, who works on race, he told me, like, race is there and you have to address it. Like, yeah, I know, but it's so hard to talk to the about the people that you like and you work with, to portray them as to actually acknowledge the fact that they are high racist and very classist, and they repeat all these dynamics that have affected Latin America in the new place. And when I started, the funny thing is that when I started kind of like reading about race in Latin America, it seems like they saw this sort of colonial, you know, these courses from colonial times, which, you know, now it must be, you know, we must be over them. But in fact, they're not. And I mean, I know as a Latin American, I know for a fact that class is intrinsic. I mean, it's intertwined with race. But the way in which it was reproduced in London was very surprising to me. But it makes sense to me, I mean, in a way of trying to, not justify it, but yeah, to understand, okay, what's going on here. It makes sense if you think about these people, how dislocated they were, right? And it's a way of, like, you know, weapons of the weak sort of thing, right? To trying to reconfigure some bits of these idealized notions of themselves by marking those differences, so you will be placed in a higher position, even when you're in a precarious. Yes. Yeah.
An obvious quick question.
Yeah.
What did you do about the christening gap?
I returned it. Yeah, it was a
fancy one.
Yes, I bought a very like a meringue, you know, one of those. I mean, actually, what I finally did after Giovanna told me that, I was like, okay, what do I do? I was like, okay, you know, I asked the mother, and I was like, you know, just come with me to the shop and choose one, because I was like, you know, I'm not a mother, I don't have any experience. Why don't you just? It's better, you know, and you know the size. I didn't know what to put it, and yeah, it was. It turned out to be these like. Very, very, no, of course it makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
This is just a thought that, and you probably don't have the answer to it, but I'm wondering whether this reproduction of class and race is also a result of what it sounds like quite tight social networks and the diaspora space. So people probably socialize mainly with other Latin Americans, mm-hmm. from what it sounds like. And it would be interesting if you could go back in 10, 15 years and talk to the second generation, because it kind of reminds me of identities reproduced among Caribbean migrants, some of which were also around sort of different shades of black, and their children didn't care about that stuff, and they had completely different racial and class identities and sort of went beyond that, and, you know, and the whole black power thing was very much... emphasized by the second generation, right? So it would be interesting to see what the second generation makes of it, because I'm sure they can criticize.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing about this, I mean, as you know, the Latin American diaspora in the UK is very recent.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're still waiting for the second generation. I mean, if they are granted visas, you know, we're still waiting. They're not expelled from the country. Yeah. But yeah, it would be interesting to see how these play out, definitely. Brazilians and Colombians.
Okay.
Yeah.
My first question is, do the Brazilians differentiate themselves of all the Latin Americans? Because, I don't know, as a Brazilian, I know that sometimes it happens as well. The second part is that what they would say about their families back in Latin America about their work, right? If they differentiate, kind of created another story about what I'm doing here in London, it's not exactly that, or etc. And how they were comfortable with this?
Yeah, of course. Your first question was
differentiated
us. Yes, they did. Of course, they are Latin Americans, but I mean, because of the language, you know, Brazil is often separated from Latin America. Let me think, because in the sort of like the people that were domestic, well, that work in domestic work, there were interactions between Brazilians and other Latin Americans. I mean, the sex workers, because of the nature of their work, they mainly remain within like their national sort of groups. And yes, of course, most women will hide. I mean, this is one of the things that migration offers. You know, it offers a space in which they can actually produce other biographies for their families back in their countries. Difficult to maintain, especially if they are in relationships or if they then get they get immersed in relationship with clients and stuff like that. But they did manage quite well to produce like two different biographies in which, you know, one was the story that the family knew back in Brazil, which was, I mean, it ranged from I teach Portuguese lessons, I am a cleaner, and I combine it with someone made this whole biography of how she was an Avon lady and she sold all these Avon products, which at some point she did, so she maintained that in order to, as a cover for her family. But I think that's what migration offers. Difficult to maintain, but they were very successful doing it. Yeah.
So it's partly related to the first part of that question, is the extent to which they saw themselves as Latin American and making sort of racial judgment, class judgments within that, or with whether there were sort of also national judgments implicit, or whether maybe the two, there was a mixture.
Yeah, no, and also it's funny because the UK doesn't have a I mean, Latin Americans cannot, you know, when in the forms we don't have any box to tick, right? I always tick other, right?
Yes.
However, Kathy McQuillan, who's this geographer at King's, who has studied the Latin American community in London, she found out that in England and Wales, most Latin Americans, when they tick the box, they will tick other white. Yes, which when I found this data, I was like, oh my god, this is. I mean, I was surprised because I would never tick myself as white other, but of course it makes sense that they do, right? However, of course, also talking about Latin America, I mean, what is Latin America, right? It's very complicated. In my case, I use it very loosely because of the nature of my research. I was initially going to work only with Bolivian migrants in London, right? And then, you know, it turned out that I started meeting people from other countries so it turned out to be it was kind of like the natural flow of my fieldwork, because people were living among other Latin Americans. They were sharing, you know, they were doing the same jobs as other Latin Americans. But of course, within Latin Americans in London, there are hierarchies, of course, you know. Brazilians and Colombians, because they are the oldest groups and the largest groups in London, they hold a different status than, for example, Ecuadorians or Bolivians. Bolivians are like at the bottom, okay. From Central America, there are very few. I had some from Honduras. But it's not... because there are so few, they don't know how to position themselves in this sort of like big group. Ecuadorians and Venezuelan people were also kind of like in the middle of Brazil, Colombia, Venezuela, and Ecuador, and then Peru and Bolivia. But this also was related to whether they had European passports or not. Ecuadorians mainly, well, Colombians, Brazilians, Brazilians. In that sense, were the ones, and still are, the ones who have less problems in terms of visas. Because Brazilians, as Mexico and Argentina, Uruguay, we don't need to apply for a visa in advance in order to come to the UK. So even though, you know, you overstay your visa, you don't have to go through the loops of applying for visas. Bolivians, it was until 2012, they were able to do this as well, and then the regulations changed. So for Bolivians, which is the most recent group that have arrived in London, they are the most undocumented migrants. Ecuadorians, a sort of chunk that have arrived into London, are the ones who arrived many years ago, like in the 90s, but also there's another chunk, a big chunk of people who came from Spain after the economic crisis. And many of the women I met here from Ecuador and Venezuela, it was their second migration. They had come from Madrid already holding European passports. And this made a difference within the Latin American community. They would be called the Españoles Desplazados within the Latin American community. And you know, it was like, oh, these like displaced Spanish, and they think they're better than us because they have passports and we don't. So legal status was also another hierarchy, another difference that of course many women use in order to prove that, you know, they have not only attained they don't only have these white racial sort of traits, but they hold national European identities, European passports.
Confirms that they must
of course,
yes.
Of course. Did you come across any women
from Southern Cone? Southern, you know,
Argentina?
Uruguay,
Uruguay,
none of those.
Chile, of course. Chile and Argentina, they are mainly those migrants that started coming from as a result of the dictatorships the biggest community of Chile, of Chilean people in London, dates back to that, quite a long time ago. And these people were, amongst like the domestic workers, cleaners, sex workers, no, I didn't encounter any of these nationalities. I think.
They're integrated now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
That was sort of the dream, the final outcome of the migration was to return and have a big house back home.
Yeah, not all of them. Many of them wanted to, especially the ones which London was a second migration. They saw the UK, you know, after having experienced this economic crisis in Madrid, they saw London as, you know, literally the land of opportunities. Like, finally, I'm going to make it here, right? But for other women, the thing is that also the range of women, you know, some of them had children, some of them they didn't. Some of them came just to study English. I mean, many of the young Colombian and young Brazilians, for example, they came to study English. They started working, you know, in these like part-time cleaner jobs in order to get some extra money, and then they found their way into sex work as a way to experiment. You know, it was kind of like, migration was kind of like, within this middle class sort of identity, migration was, just searching for new adventures, experiences. There were others that were highly in debt back in their countries, and of course migration was a project in which, you know, they will be able to pay their debt backs. And those were the ones who wanted to go back, and the ones who left families back in their countries. But many of them have stayed, actually, married other Latin Americans here. Some of them married British people, British clients. It was half, I would say, that some of them did go back and have returned. It's like a cycle, like a migratory cycle as well. One of them has gone back and forth to Brazil, yeah.
That's interesting. I see another paper in there if you need suggestions.
Yeah, that would be good.
So life course.
Yeah, I know. I have one that I can follow.
And dreams of returning or staying, aspirations.
Yeah. Especially I have one of my closest friends, she's in Brazil. she worked as a sex worker, and she has gone back to Brazil twice. The second time she brought her son back. Now the son is here. She went back again, and now she's back again. And the whole returning migration is because, you know, she wants to make a little bit more money in order to finish, you know, buy another flat in Sao Paulo. She wants, okay, just a little bit more money in order to buy another flat in Sao Paulo. And this is a woman who made £300,000 a year working in sex work. So
it's hard to let go of that, isn't
it? Yeah. Yeah. Which is a unique case. Very unique case, but yeah, but she did. So every time she promised me all the time, like, no, I'm back. I'm staying in Sao Paulo. And then she's like, I'm going back to, are you, just a little bit, you know, because I saw this flat that I really like, and if I work 6 months, I won't be able to get it. So yeah, of course there is this thing. Especially when they're able to establish their business in London. This is with the sex workers, domestic workers, is another story.
Thank you very much.